January 22nd, 1989, Temecula, California. The housemate of 30-year-old Marine Captain Jeffrey Digman returns to the residence and discovers that Jeffrey has been shot to death inside his bedroom. Since a gun Jeffrey owns is lying next to him, his death is ruled to be a suicide, and investigators theorize that he had become despondent over a recent transfer to Puerto Rico. However, Jeffrey's parents discover some suspicious discrepancies to make them suspect he was murdered, and even though his cause of death has changed from suicide to undetermined, there are no conclusive answers about how he was killed. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring two separate cases from Unsolved Mysteries involving three servicemen who were ruled to be the victims of suspicious suicides: the 1989 death of Jeffrey Digman and the 1992 deaths of Billy Ray Hargrove and Mike Carmichael. Unsolved Mysteries featured their fair share of stories about servicemen who died under strange circumstances. And while the military ruled their deaths to be suicides, their families believed they were the victims of foul play and that a cover-up was taking place. Our first story involves Jeffrey Digman, a captain in the United States Marine Corps, who was found dead of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound at his residence in California. Months earlier, Digman had received a transfer to a new posting in Puerto Rico, and since he was killed on the same night he was supposed to fly back there, and also had a history of heavy drinking and morose behavior, investigators concluded that his death was a suicide. However, Jeffrey's parents performed a number of tests and hired a bunch of independent experts who felt that some of the physical evidence and the positioning of Jeffrey's body did not match the suicide ruling. The Digmans suspected that Jeffrey may have been murdered over work he performed as part of a drug testing unit in the Marines. Our second story is particularly unique because it involves two Army officers, Billy Ray Hargrove and Mike Carmichael, who are best friends and both died by suicide within a month and a half of each other while stationed in South Korea. What's odd about this whole situation is that while Hargrove hung himself from a tree in his yard, the suicide scenario was not implausible because he was experiencing a number of personal problems at the time, including an upcoming court-martial. In spite of this, Carmichael still believed that Hargrove had been murdered, and weeks later, he would wind up dead in an apparent suicide in which he allegedly hanged himself with a parachute cord from the handle of a locker that was only a few inches off the ground. While the Army believed that Carmichael may have become despondent over the loss of his best friend, the families of the two deceased soldiers did not agree with this and felt that Carmichael may have been killed because he uncovered incriminating information about Hargrove's death. So on this episode, I'm going to start off by discussing Digman's case before I move on to Hargrove and Carmichael, and then I'll provide my own theories and analysis about both these cases. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the unexplained death of Jeffrey Digman. Our first story begins in 1989 in Temecula, California, a city located in Riverside County about 50 miles north of San Diego. Our first central figure is 30-year-old Jeffrey Digman, who was a captain in the United States Marine Corps. Originally born in Anaheim, Jeffrey had wanted to be a Marine since childhood, and even went so far as to get his first buzz cut at age 4. While attending university, Jeffrey signed up for the Marines and was accepted into Officers Candidate School, and he wound up being promoted to captain at age 28. While stationed at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego, Jeffrey and his supervising officer, Major Douglas Wood, decided to pool their money and purchase a suburban house together on June Court in Temecula. However, in November of 1988, Jeffrey was transferred to a new posting in Puerto Rico, where he would work as a range control officer. While he was not particularly thrilled about the situation, Jeffrey attempted to make the best of it and started dating Lucy Garcia, an accountant who worked at his base. Well, after the start of the new year, Jeffrey returned to California for a 2-week vacation and stayed at his house in Temecula. He was scheduled to fly back to Puerto Rico on Sunday, January the 22nd, while his housemate, Major Douglas Wood, was away with his girlfriend in Las Vegas on a weekend trip. Well, at around 10 p.m. that evening, Wood and his girlfriend returned to his residence, but were surprised to discover that Jeffrey's car was parked in the driveway, even though his flight to Puerto Rico had been scheduled to leave 15 minutes earlier. Wood also noticed that lights were still on in the house and the garage door was open, so became concerned enough to contact a neighbor and ask if he would accompany him and his girlfriend when they went inside. When the trio entered the house, they soon went into Jeffrey's bedroom and were shocked to discover his dead body lying on his back across the bed. Jeffrey had been shot once through the right temple just above his ear, and a .44 Magnum revolver he owned was lying on the bed next to his right hand. The Riverside County Sheriff's Department was summoned to the scene and soon spoke to a neighbor who claimed they saw Jeffrey parking his car and walking into his house earlier that evening, sometime between 5:30 and 6 p.m. They were certain of the time frame since this happened to be Super Bowl Sunday and the game's halftime show was playing on TV when Jeffrey arrived. Shortly thereafter, at around 6 o'clock, numerous neighbors recalled hearing what sounded like a car backfiring, though it may have been the gunshot which killed Jeffrey. After speaking with some of Jeffrey's friends, investigators started to believe that his death was a suicide, possibly brought on by his unhappiness over his recent transfer to Puerto Rico. Jeffrey was described as being a very hard-working and meticulous Marine who took his job quite seriously and was well-liked by those who served with him. But he was also known for being very quiet and painfully shy, and his demeanor had earned him the nickname Dr. Gloom. Jeffrey's housemate, Major Wood, said that he was a meticulously neat person who didn't even like it when people put glasses on the coffee table and was often possessive about his personal belongings. Some of Jeffrey's friends said he had been angry with Wood prior to his death, as Wood had allegedly used his bedroom while he was in Puerto Rico without asking Jeffrey's permission. While Wood said that he had invited Jeffrey to accompany him and his girlfriend on their trip to Las Vegas, Jeffrey had declined. One of Jeffrey's friends said that she spoke to him shortly before his death and said she did not detect anything out of the ordinary. She had offered him a ride to the airport for his flight, but Jeffrey told her that Wood was going to drive him there. It turned out that Jeffrey had a blood alcohol level of 0.24, which was 3 times the legal limit for intoxication, and there were 5 empty beer cans inside the bedroom. According to his friends, while Jeffrey did not often drink publicly, he would frequently consume alcohol inside his own room and would sometimes drink himself to sleep. Wood told investigators that he was concerned that Jeffrey might need professional help because he was experiencing a lot of personal stress and seemed to have a drinking problem, but Wood said he did not notify his superiors or turn Jeffrey in because he feared this might ruin Jeffrey's career and possibly prompt him to take his own life. A gunshot residue test would turn up traces of gunpowder on Jeffrey's right hand, but the Riverside County Sheriff's Department still decided to seek outside assistance from the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, aka the NCIS. After a thorough year-long investigation, both agencies officially reached the conclusion that Jeffrey's death was a suicide and closed the case in January of 1990. However, Jeffrey's parents, Bill and Donna Digman, did not believe this and suspected that he had been the victim of foul play. This same opinion was held by Jeffrey's girlfriend in Puerto Rico, Lucy Garcia, who claimed that Jeffrey seemed completely normal the last time they spoke on the phone. Jeffrey had arranged for Lucy to pick him up at the airport when his flight arrived, and he also asked her to have his dress uniform cleaned because he would be undergoing an inspection upon his return. Jeffrey's parents decided to perform their own independent investigation into his death, which included reconstructing Jeffrey's childhood bedroom at their home to resemble his bedroom in Temecula. This involved using the original furniture and allowed them to recreate the circumstances of Jeffrey's death scene as closely as possible. Bill Digman also hooked up a string, which ran from Jeffrey's bed to the ceiling, to mark the trajectory of the bullet which killed him. While the bullet had presumably went through the ceiling of Jeffrey's bedroom, it was never actually recovered by investigators, and even though Jeffrey's right hand had traces of gunshot residue, no tests were performed to conclusively determine if the .44 Magnum found by Jeffrey's hand had actually fired the fatal shot. The Digmans felt that the wound on Jeffrey's temple appeared to be too small to have been made by such a powerful gun like a Magnum, and also found it suspicious that the mattress and bloody bedspread was disposed of the morning after Jeffrey's death, without anyone checking if the missing bullet might have been lodged there. Bill and Donna spent over $75,000 of their own money to hire a number of independent forensic experts to have a look at their son's death, including two detectives, four pathologists, and one scientist. This included Dr. Vincent Amayo and Dr. Cyril Wecht, two of the most famous forensic pathologists in the United States. While neither of these men could make the conclusive ruling that Jeffrey's death was a homicide, they both had issues with how the original investigation was carried out. Dr. DeMaio stated, quote, "You've got three possibilities. It's homicide, suicide, or that the case is so screwed up, you are never going to figure out what this is, which is what this case may be." End quote. As for Dr. Wecht, he believed that at the very least, Jeffrey's death should have been classified as undetermined rather than suicide, stating, quote, "There is more hard evidence against a determination of suicide than for it. There is a lot of good, solid evidence that shows it would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, for a suicide to have occurred in the manner that was described." End quote. Another forensic expert hired by the Digmans was Stephen Schliebe, a criminalist with the California Laboratory of Forensic Science, who believed that Jeffrey had been involved in some sort of struggle with an unknown party prior to his death. Indeed, there appeared to be a few injuries on Jeffrey's body, including an abrasion on his right cheekbone. 10 months after Jeffrey's death, his parents had requested for his body to be exhumed so that a new autopsy could be performed at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego with their own outside observers present. The medical examiner found two new contusions on Jeffrey's right elbow and left middle finger, which had not been mentioned in the original autopsy report, but he also noted that these new injuries were relatively insignificant and there was still not enough evidence to support a conclusion of homicide, which is why the original investigation was closed. There was also an unexplained smear of blood on the bed sheets above Jeffrey's head, which did not appear to have been caused by the fatal gunshot, and may have been left there by an additional person who touched the sheets, possibly after they got Jeffrey's blood on them. There was also concern about the fact that Jeffrey had supposedly fired the shot with his right hand, even though he was left-handed. The Digmans hired the services of a retired FBI agent turned private investigator named Ted Gunderson, who examined the trajectory of the bullet and the position Jeffrey's body was found, and concluded that if it was a suicide, Jeffrey would have needed to lean sideways away from the bed and hold the gun upside down when he shot himself. He also would have needed to put the gun directly against his head, creating a star-shaped contact wound, yet the original autopsy report simply described it as a quote-unquote near-contact wound and said it was not star-shaped. Gunderson also believed that if Jeffrey shot himself in this contorted position, his body would have fallen forward to the floor and he would not have been lying on his back atop the bed. There was also a trail of blood running down Jeffrey's left cheek from the exit wound by his left ear, which seemed to suggest that he was in an upright position for at least 7 seconds after he was shot. This led Gunderson to conclude that Jeffrey had been shot by an unknown party who subsequently placed his body on top of the bed. Prior to his transfer to Puerto Rico, Jeffrey had been the chief of a drug testing unit at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego, and his parents became convinced that this played a role in his death. According to Bill Digman, Jeffrey's superiors had not been taking him seriously, and during his interview on Unsolved Mysteries, Bill stated, quote, "People were dealing drugs. People were testing positive. He would write his reports documenting what the results of his investigations were. And those people weren't being disciplined. They were not being discharged. And he was very upset over that," end quote. At one point, Donna Digman said that she visited Jeffrey at his house in Temecula and noticed an open safe, which he kept behind a hinged door inside a secretary desk in his bedroom. At the time, there appeared to be some military documents inside the safe, and Jeffrey told Donna that they were related to drug abuse tests he had conducted, and he was saving them in case anybody tried to say he had not done his job properly. Following Jeffrey's death, the Digmans wanted to check this safe, but discovered that the door on the desk was broken because the hinges were no longer connected and the safe was now missing. Since the Digmans never saw the safe again, they came to believe that Jeffrey may have been murdered by someone who wanted to retrieve the documents inside. Lucy Garcia also became suspicious when she helped some Marines pack up Jeffrey's personal belongings in Puerto Rico. Lucy claimed that she found a small green diary, and when she gave it to one of the Marines who was with her, she witnessed him open it and noticed that all of its pages were intact. However, when the Marine shipped all of Jeffrey's belongings to his parents and they received the diary, it now had several pages cut out of it. Once again, the Digmans suspected that Jeffrey may have had incriminating information written down in the diary, possibly about drug abuse in the Marines, which paved the way for him being murdered. At one point, the Digmans filed a lawsuit against the Navy, the Marine Corps, and Jeffrey's supervising officer and housemate, Major Wood, for wrongful death, obstruction of justice, and conspiracy to falsify a government investigation. While I wasn't able to find any concrete information about how the lawsuit turned out, I can only assume it was dismissed. However, in April of 1991, Dr. Richard Freedy, the medical examiner from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, agreed to view both of the autopsy reports, and based on the evidence, he decided to officially change the cause of Jeffrey's death from suicide to undetermined. In spite of this, the NCIS and the Riverside County Sheriff's Department continued to stand by their original ruling that Jeffrey's death was a suicide and said they would not reopen the investigation unless new evidence was presented to them. Even though this case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in November of 1991, it did not lead to any new developments, and tragically, Bill Digman passed away in 2014 at the age of 89. So after 35 years, the full truth about the circumstances of Jeffrey Digman's death remain up for debate. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. And now let's move on to our next story. Our second story begins in South Korea in 1992. Our first victim is 30-year-old William Ray Hargrove, a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army who goes by the name Billy Ray and lives at his posting with his Korean wife, Kim. Billy Ray was originally born in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and 1 year earlier, his platoon had been sent from Germany to Saudi Arabia to serve in Operation Desert Storm during the Gulf War, though they never actually saw combat. Regardless, Billy Ray still felt that all members of his platoon deserved medals for their service, but his superiors declined his recommendation, as they did not believe the platoon's actions during the conflict merited such an award. However, Billy Ray decided to forge his superior officer's signature on a phony letter of recommendation, so his platoon wound up receiving their medals. In June of 1991, Billy Ray was transferred to South Korea for his next tour of duty, but by the time he arrived, the letter of recommendation was determined to be fraudulent. As a result, when Billy Ray touched down at the airport, he was immediately arrested by the military police, who removed his Desert Storm commendation and charged him with forgery. Billy Ray would continue serving at his new posting while awaiting his court-martial, and by the time January rolled around, he phoned his father, Harvey Hargrove, and informed him that he was planning to leave the military because he was fed up with it, and he hoped to return home by June. It also seemed apparent that Billy Ray's marriage to his wife Kim was falling apart, and he was planning to divorce her. According to his mother, Sue Nunnally, when she paid her son a visit, Billy Ray and Kim were constantly fighting, as she frequently accused him of cheating on her and having a child with another woman. Well, things seemed to reach a breaking point for Billy Ray when another Army sergeant paid him a visit at his residence at around 9:20 a.m. on the morning of February the 20th. The sergeant informed Billy Ray that he had missed a summons he received for a training exercise, which angered his captain. Billy Ray said he would report for duty immediately, but after the sergeant left, Kim said that Billy Ray made the inexplicable decision to go outside and take their dog for a walk. About 20 minutes later, Kim heard the dog barking, and when she headed outside, she was shocked to discover Billy Ray's body hanging by a parachute cord from a tree. A handwritten suicide note was found in Billy Ray's pants pocket, which contained this excerpt. Quote, "My life is really screwed up now. I just don't know how to fix it. I've been thinking a lot about taking my life for a long time now. Goodbye." End quote. Well, given Billy Ray's numerous personal problems at that time, there did not seem to be any reason to doubt that his death was a suicide, and Kim apparently accepted the official ruling. However, Billy Ray's family still had a hard time believing he would have taken his own life. When Sue Nunnally received a photocopy of the suicide note, she did not believe it was in Billy Ray's handwriting, and oddly, the Army even seemed to acknowledge that the writing may not have been his. When Billy Ray's family looked at the autopsy report, they noticed that he had unexplained cuts and abrasions on his face, hands, and knuckles, which suggested that he may have gotten into a fight with someone prior to his death. And since Billy Ray's body was found hanging only inches from the ground, they had a hard time believing he would have been able to asphyxiate himself with an elastic-like parachute cord. Another person who was skeptical of the suicide ruling was Billy Ray's 37-year-old best friend, Nirma Faye Carmichael, who went by the name Mike. Originally born in North Carolina, Mike enlisted in the Army during his teens and eventually wound up becoming close friends with Billy Ray. Mike held the rank of Sergeant First Class and had also served in Operation Desert Storm, and much like Billy Ray, he also met and got married to a Korean woman while serving in the Far East. Prior to that, Mike had already been through one divorce and had three daughters from his previous marriage, but he tied the knot with his second wife, Sun Hee, in July of 1991. Billy Ray's body was shipped back home, and he was laid to rest in Little Rock National Cemetery in Arkansas on March the 4th, but while attending the funeral, Mike assured Billy Ray's family that he would launch his own investigation into Billy Ray's death. Even though Billy Ray previously expressed disillusionment with the Army, Mike said that he had changed his mind and was planning to re-enlist, which is one reason Mike doubted the suicide ruling. According to Harvey Hargrove, Mike told him, quote, "We'll give them hell. We're gonna make them pay. The SOBs pay for what they've done." End quote. Mike later paid a visit to his own uncle, a retired Marine named Oscar Carmichael, and told him that he believed there was a big conspiracy surrounding Billy Ray's death. He also said there were at least three other soldiers who had died under suspicious circumstances while serving in South Korea, but their deaths were also ruled to be a suicide. In fact, Mike told his mother that he feared he would be the next soldier to die. After he returned to South Korea, Mike and Sun Hee visited Kim in order to collect Billy Ray's belongings and personal papers. This included a letter which Billy Ray had written to his father shortly before his death and was never sent to him, though its contents are still unknown. All of Billy Ray's personal papers, as well as documents from Mike's supposed investigation into his death, were apparently placed inside a metal box. According to his uncle Oscar, Mike said that if anything ever happened to him, his family needed to get a hold of this box as soon as possible. Well, on the evening of April the 3rd, Mike and Sun Hee invited a number of friends to their residence to celebrate Mike's 38th birthday, but at around 10 p.m., he received an unexpected phone call and told everyone that he had been ordered back to the base. Mike then left, but by the following morning, he had still not returned home, prompting Sun Hee to phone the base. The guard Sun Hee spoke to said that no one had seen or heard from Mike, and when she asked him to knock on the door to his barracks office, He said there was no answer and the door was locked. This prompted Sahi to head over to the base to check the barracks office herself, but when she went inside, she discovered Mike's body leaning against a metal locker in an odd sitting position. Much like when Billy Ray was killed, Mike had an elastic-like parachute cord wrapped around his neck, and it was tied to the locker's door handle. The NCIS would determine that Mike had been dead for several hours before he was found, but even though his body was hanging only a few inches off the ground, they also ruled his death to be a suicide. They theorized that Mike had become so despondent over the death of his best friend that he decided to take his own life, and financial issues may have also played a role in his decision. After reaching the milestone of 20 years of service, Mike was planning to retire from the Army in October of that year, but he was apparently fearful that his ex-wife would attempt to sue him for half of his retirement pay, even though his family said she had previously signed an agreement stating that she would not do this. Mike's body was transported back to the U.S., and he was laid to rest alongside Billy Ray at Little Rock National Cemetery. Sun Hee would later say that she noticed a metal wire around Mike's death when she discovered his body, but in spite of this odd discrepancy, she accepted the suicide ruling. Well, not surprisingly, Mike's family did not feel the same way, as they thought that he seemed happy during his marriage and was looking forward to his retirement, so they had a hard time believing he was suicidal. Much like Billy Ray, Mike had some unexplained welts on his face and a gash on his forehead, which made his family suspect that he may have been struck by an object before a suicide was staged. There were also issues with the fact that Mike's death was not treated like a potential crime scene, as his body was immediately cut down and evidence was disturbed in the barracks office before the NCIS arrived. The original sketch of the crime scene featured a rectangular object which was resting on a desk near Mike's body. His uncle Oscar believed that this was the metal box Mike had mentioned, which contained all of Billy Ray's personal papers, but it was never sent to the Carmichael family and just seemed to disappear without explanation, though the Army denied that this box even existed in the first place. Mike and Billy Ray's families worked together to start a letter-writing campaign in order to obtain all the official reports from the military, and they managed to do so after reaching out to and receiving assistance from Jay Dickey, the U.S. representative for Arkansas's 4th Congressional District, who also believed that some sort of cover-up may have been taking place. Even when Dickey's staff received some of the official reports, they often seemed to be lacking, as crime scene photos were missing, and certain details would be withheld or whited out. A segment about the story was produced by Unsolved Mysteries, who featured it in an episode which aired in February of 1994. A congressional hearing would later be held in order to take a second look at both men's deaths, but they ultimately reached the conclusion to uphold the Army's original findings of suicide. In spite of this, the victims' loved ones believed that the hearing was nothing more than a formality. They continue to maintain that foul play had taken place, so after 3 decades, the deaths of Billy Ray Hargrove and Mike Carmichael are still shrouded in controversy. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So Unsolved Mysteries produced quite a few segments about suspicious military suicides, as this was a topic which got quite a bit of coverage in the media during the mid to late 1990s. You might recall that last year, on episode number 334, we released a Trail Went Cold episode about the unexplained 1992 death of Chad Langford, an Army military policeman who died under suspicious circumstances at the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama, and what was ruled to be a suicide that he staged on his own. That case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in February of 1993, and a few months later, in May of that year, Langford's story was just one of many that was featured in an extensive article published by the Philadelphia Inquirer, which focused on the suspicious deaths of 14 servicemen from the United States Armed Forces. Even though the military had officially ruled that all these deaths were suicide or accidental, their families were certain they had been murdered, and were pushing for the cases to be reopened. In fact, some of these families would even go on to testify before the House Armed Services Committee. The deaths of Billy Ray Hargrove and Mike Carmichael were featured in this article, and that's where Unsolved Mysteries learned about them and felt compelled to produce a separate segment about their story. The original article got so much attention that a number of other families were compelled to come forward and share their accounts of how their loved ones died under suspicious circumstances while serving in the military. As a result, the Philadelphia Inquirer would publish a more extensive four-part series of articles about this topic in December of 1993, which were titled The Suicide Files. It profiled no less than 40 of these suspicious deaths, and one of them was the alleged suicide of Jeffrey Dingman. The Inquirer asked four retired military investigators to review 19 of the featured cases, and they all concluded that the evidence did not fully support the original suicide rulings. Now, I haven't reviewed each and every one of these cases, so I'm not sure if any of the rulings were ever overturned, but even if all these deaths were actually suicides all along, that still pointed to a major systemic issue in the military. Now, whenever I've covered any of these suspicious suicide cases from Unsolved Mysteries, I've always mentioned that when I first learned about them during the 1980s or 1990s, I almost always took the show's presentation at face value and believed the family's allegations that foul play had taken place. But of course, now that I've become older and learned so much more about the topic of suicide, depression, and mental health, I now realize that some of these families were likely in denial. They seemed to have a hard time coming to terms with what they perceived to be a stigma surrounding the act of taking one's own life, which is why they would come up with these conspiracies involving murder. Before it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, Jeffrey Dingman's case got quite a bit of coverage in the Los Angeles Times, and one of their articles featured this quote from Marine Gunnery Sergeant Larry Crutchfield, who had served under Jeffrey, and made a remark that may have summed up a general attitude towards suicide at that time. Quote, "We learn never to give up, no matter how hard the going gets. It's the way we are designed, if you will. Suicide goes against every little fiber in a Marine." End quote. The Unsolved Mystery segment about Hargrove and Carmichael also contains a rather cringeworthy moment during the interview with Mike's uncle, Oscar, who states that his nephew never would have, quote-unquote, taken the chicken way out. So if any of these servicemen were suffering from depression or other serious mental health issues at that time, you can understand why they may have been compelled to stay silent about it and kept their struggles private. While the families of Jeffrey Dingman, Billy Ray Hargrove, and Mike Carmichael repeatedly stated that none of these men would have considered suicide, the possibility really does not seem implausible at all. After reading the Los Angeles Times articles about the Dingman case, it seems like Unsolved Mysteries downplayed his potential issues with alcohol and a sometimes morose attitude, which caused him to earn the nickname Dr. Gloom. Hargrove's life was on a complete downward spiral at the time of his death, so if it wasn't for the subsequent death of his best friend, I really don't think there would be any doubt that Hargrove died by suicide or there was any real mystery to this story at all. However, I do have to acknowledge that Carmichael's death is definitely quite unusual, and I think an argument could be made that a suicide was staged. But the problem is that the theory pushed forward by Carmichael's loved ones is that he was murdered because he uncovered incriminating information about Hargrove's death. Yet if Hargrove's death was suicide all along, what motive would anyone have had to kill Carmichael? A big issue with all three of these cases is that there doesn't seem to be a particularly strong reason to murder any of these men and orchestrate a major cover-up. So after researching a number of these suicide cases, I no longer put much stock into statements about how the victim never would have done something like that because they were very happy and had too much to live for. Suicidal people can sometimes be very unpredictable and take everyone by complete surprise when they go through the act completely out of nowhere. Just because a person seems fine on the outside does not necessarily mean they aren't struggling on the inside. However, even if you put aside motive, I will acknowledge that each of these cases has some details, mostly involving the physical evidence, which suggests there might be more to these stories, so a full analysis is definitely worthwhile. So we'll start off by discussing Jeffrey Dingman. Even though Jeffrey seemed to be a very good soldier who was well-liked by everyone who knew him, it sounds like he was also painfully shy and quiet. But ironically, it doesn't sound like he had much trouble finding girlfriends. I mentioned how Jeffrey had started dating Lucy Garcia, an accountant at his base in Puerto Rico, but I learned that he also had two other girlfriends during this time period. It seems like Jeffrey was particularly introverted in larger social situations, which is why he often liked to spend a lot of time drinking alone. I mentioned earlier that at the time of his death, Jeffrey had a blood alcohol level of 0.24, which is 3 times over the legal limit for intoxication. While there were 5 empty beer cans found at the scene, there's no evidence to indicate that anyone forced Jeffrey to drink alcohol against his will. If he was the victim of foul play, it seems like quite a lucky coincidence that someone would manage to kill him while he was that intoxicated, but if he was planning suicide, it's easy to believe he may have decided to get drunk in order to work himself up to go through with it. The biggest potential motive which has been pushed forward for suicide was the fact that Jeffrey was unhappy about being transferred to a new posting in Puerto Rico just under 3 months earlier. Of course, anyone who joins the military knows they can be transferred at any time, but since all of Jeffrey's ties were in California, I could see him having a hard time making the adjustment to living over 3,000 miles away. It's interesting timing how Jeffrey's death would take place while he was on a 2-week vacation in California, and he decided to get very intoxicated right before a scheduled return flight to Puerto Rico. His behavior seems to indicate that he couldn't stand the thought of going back there. Yes, there were signs that Jeffrey had no plans to kill himself, as he had asked his girlfriend to pick him up from the airport in Puerto Rico and have his dress uniform cleaned, which he obviously wouldn't have to worry about if he was planning to end his own life. But like I've reiterated many times before, sometimes suicide can just be an impulsive, spur-of-the-moment decision. All that being said, the main reason people have suspicions that there might be more to this story is because of the actions of Jeffrey's housemate, Major Douglas Wood. As you recall, Wood and his girlfriend had been away on a weekend trip to Las Vegas when Jeffrey's death took place, and returned home to discover his body. Even though the two Marines had made the commitment to buy a house together, it does not sound like they had the best relationship at that time, as Jeffrey was apparently very meticulous about keeping the place neat, and was very possessive about his personal belongings and his personal space. It sounds like it may have been driving Jeffrey nuts that Wood had the house to himself while he was in Puerto Rico, which allowed him to do things like use Jeffrey's bedroom without his permission. But would these issues have been serious enough to escalate into murder? The story provided by Major Wood is that when he returned home from Vegas, he was surprised to see Jeffrey's car in the driveway because his return flight to Puerto Rico had been scheduled to leave 15 minutes earlier. This detail is always very confusing to me, because I'm not entirely sure what Jeffrey was planning to use as transportation to the airport. Earlier that night, he had spoken to a female friend on the phone who offered him a ride there, but Jeffrey said that Wood was planning to drive him. However, that doesn't really fit the timeline, since Wood did not arrive home until after the flight already left. I guess Jeffrey could have been planning to drive himself to the airport in his own car, though that probably would have cost him a fortune in long-term parking fees, and it really wouldn't have been advisable for him to make that drive with a 0.24 blood alcohol level. So I guess it's possible that when Jeffrey last spoke with his friend, he had already made the decision to kill himself and just made up the part about Wood driving him to the airport so that she wouldn't worry about the situation. However, it does strike me as really odd that when Wood returned home, the sight of Jeffrey's car still being parked in the driveway, as well as the lights being on in the house, instantly made him concerned enough to ask a neighbor to accompany him inside. Why was he so certain that something bad might have happened? How did he know that Jeffrey simply hadn't decided to stay a bit longer and return to Puerto Rico on a later flight or something? Now, there are documented cases in which murderers have set things up to have witnesses alongside them when they quote-unquote discover their victims' bodies, so they can put on a show to make themselves look like a shocked, innocent bystander. So I can understand why people might be inclined to think that Wood did the same thing here and arranged to have a neighbor with him when he found Jeffrey. Of course, I've never seen any indication that investigators ever considered Wood to be a possible suspect. Many neighbors reported hearing what sounded like a car backfiring at 6 p.m., which may have been the fatal gunshot that killed Jeffrey, but Wood did not actually return until 10 p.m., so for all we know, his girlfriend may have been able to vouch that Wood was nowhere near the house when Jeffrey was believed to have been killed, and he could have had an airtight alibi. But I think the alternate possibility is that Wood may have had his own personal suspicions that Jeffrey was suicidal, so when he returned home and saw that Jeffrey's car was still parked there, alarm bells may have gone off in his head that Jeffrey had done something and he didn't want to find his body alone. When Wood was originally interviewed by investigators, he did express his belief that Jeffrey may have had substance abuse issues, but he neglected to inform his superiors about it because he feared it could ruin Jeffrey's career and prompt him to take his own life. But oddly, when Wood was interviewed about this in the Los Angeles Times nearly 2 years after Jeffrey's death, he seemed to completely downplay all this and contradict himself, stating, quote, "There wasn't any time I felt he was suicidal. I'm not a doctor," end quote. Of course, it's important to remember that even though Wood was Jeffrey's friend, he technically had been his supervising officer when they were stationed together at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. So Wood may have been trying to downplay the fact that he knew Jeffrey was experiencing some personal issues, but helped cover for him rather than report it. One theory which has been pushed forward in online discussions about this case is that Wood may not have been involved in Jeffrey's death, but returned home earlier than he claimed and discovered Jeffrey's body on his own. If Wood moved his body or did anything to compromise the crime scene, he may have come up with a fabricated scenario in which he, quote-unquote, discovered Jeffrey alongside his neighbor in order to give himself plausible deniability. I mean, even though I don't believe the case for homicide is particularly compelling here, I do think that some of the physical evidence leans away from suicide. One thing that the Digman, Hargrove, and Carmichael deaths all have in common is that all three men had unexplained abrasions on their bodies, but since Digman was heavily intoxicated at that time, perhaps he caused those abrasions himself when he bumped or stumbled into something, as the coroner did not think that these injuries were severe enough to suggest foul play. I know that Jeffrey's parents consulted with a number of experts who believed that the placement of his body did not fit the suicide theory, and I can see their point. But while some of these experts, such as Dr. Vincent DiMaio and Dr. Cyril Wecht, are renowned figures in their field, Ted Gunderson, who firmly believed that Jeffrey was murdered, is quite a troubling and polarizing individual. I won't go into too many details about his background, but if you feel compelled to check out his Wikipedia page, it's pretty wild stuff, as Gunderson was once described as a quote-unquote recognized spokesman on the dangers of satanic ritual cults. So obviously, I would take any of the conclusions he made with a huge grain of salt, as he seems like a guy who always reaches conclusions involving conspiracies. The Digmans and all of their experts seemed to put a lot of stock into the fact that Jeffrey was left-handed, which meant that he would have needed to hold the gun in a really awkward position if he shot himself. But I don't know why this would preclude the idea that he could have used his right hand to pull the trigger, particularly since there was gunshot residue on that hand, and he was very intoxicated at the time and may not have been thinking clearly. I will agree that it's very frustrating that investigators did not make a more concerted effort to retrieve the bullet which passed through Jeffrey's temple, and it boggles my mind that they didn't even conclusively establish that the .44 Magnum revolver by his side was the same gun used to shoot him. I mean, if foul play did take place and there was an intruder, perhaps the reason Jeffrey had gunshot residue on his hand is because he attempted to use the Magnum to defend himself, but he was actually shot with another firearm. While all this is just speculation on my part, if Jeffrey's death was a suicide and Major Wood is not telling the whole truth and actually moved Jeffrey's body when he found it, this could account for why Jeffrey was found in a position which didn't seem to line up with the trajectory of the bullet. This could help explain some of the odd pieces of evidence, such as the blood smear on the bed sheets above Jeffrey's head, which looked like it may have been left there by another person. Granted, if Wood interfered by the crime scene and moved Jeffrey's body in the heat of the moment, I'm not sure why he wouldn't tell anyone, but as a Marine, Perhaps he felt there would be repercussions if he admitted to this. Again, one of my biggest issues with the foul play theory is that we don't really have a compelling motive for why anyone would kill Jeffrey and stage his death to look like a suicide. The best theory his parents have dreamed up is that he was murdered over his work as the chief of the drug testing unit at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego, but that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, given that he hadn't held the position for several months and was now working in Puerto Rico. I know Jeffrey had made some remarks to his father, in which he supposedly complained about some drug abuse and drug dealing he had witnessed, which his superiors were not taking seriously, and perhaps if he was rocking the boat too much, that could explain why he was transferred over 3,000 miles away. We know that Jeffrey had been back in California on a 2-week vacation prior to his death, and if he had made some remarks about how he uncovered incriminating evidence about a major drug scandal in the Marines and was about to blow the lid off the whole thing, I might be more willing to consider the possibility that he had put his life in danger, but that doesn't appear to be the case. Furthermore, unlike the Hargrove and Carmichael cases, Jeffrey's death did not take place at a military posting, as it was originally investigated by a civilian law enforcement agency, the Riverside County Sheriff's Department. Yes, they did eventually ask for assistance from the NCIS, but that was 6 months after the fact, so what motivation would the sheriff's office have to cover up a potential murder involving the military? Yes, there were mistakes made during the investigation, but you can't accuse these agencies of not trying to explore all angles, as they did not officially rule Jeffrey's death to be a suicide and close the case until a year after the fact. The two details which had been used as evidence that something might have been covered up were the disappearance of a safe from Jeffrey's bedroom and some pages from a green diary that was collected among his personal belongings in Puerto Rico. Well, there's actually a thread about this case at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, containing interesting comments from a pair of posters under the usernames Hops3098 and MegTheEgg86, who have both served in the military and claim that they used their own little Green Diary-style books during the line of duty. Apparently, these types of books are fairly common, and soldiers will often write down sensitive, classified information in them, but it's their responsibility to either black this information out or remove the pages once it's no longer useful. So it's possible that Jeffrey's green book contained information like this, which was not supposed to be seen by civilians, which could explain why a number of pages were cut out before it was sent to Jeffrey's parents. It sounds like this is completely standard procedure and doesn't necessarily mean these missing pages had incriminating information about something like a drug scandal which played a role in Jeffrey being murdered. You could probably apply the same logic towards Jeffrey's missing safe. If it really did contain documents about Jeffrey's drug testing investigations, that is technically confidential information which the military would not want to hand over to his family. The safe may very well simply have been collected as evidence after the fact and was not stolen by someone who murdered Jeffrey because they wanted the documents inside. While I don't really put much stock into any of the foul play theories in this case, I do have to acknowledge that Jeffrey's official cause of death was eventually changed from suicide to undetermined by the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. So there are still some odd discrepancies which left them uncertain that Jeffrey really did kill himself. I can definitely concur that undetermined is probably an appropriate ruling for this case, but that still doesn't mean he was the victim of a homicide. If there was a stronger motive for foul play, and Jeffrey did not have such a high blood alcohol content, I would probably lean more towards him being murdered. But all the stories about Jeffrey's drinking and his morose attitude make me think that he had some issues which he kept bottled up inside. And if Jeffrey felt that he could just not open up about them, I can see why he might have reached his breaking point. While I wouldn't say I am 100% on the matter, overall, I do lean towards suicide. So now we're going to move on and start talking about the deaths of Billy Ray Hargrove and Mike Carmichael. Like I mentioned earlier, if Mike had not died under odd circumstances just 6 weeks later, I really think there wouldn't be any debate at all in Billy Ray's case, as it seems pretty obvious that his death was a suicide. Forging a superior officer's signature on a phony letter of recommendation to get medals for his platoon was an incredibly bad idea, And while Mike tried to say that the controversy was subsiding and Billy Ray was still planning to re-enlist, it would not surprise me at all if an offense like this ruined his career. According to Article 123 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the maximum punishment one can receive for forgery is forfeiture of all allowances and pay, dishonorable discharge, and 5 years confinement. If Billy Ray had lived long enough for his court-martial, I have no idea if he would have received that punishment, but when you combine this situation with the fact that his marriage was falling apart and he was planning to divorce his wife, Kim, it's clear that Billy Ray was in a really bad place. I don't know how long he may have been contemplating suicide, but it's possible his breaking point was when the Army sergeant showed up at his door and informed Billy Ray that he was late to a training exercise, which likely meant he was going to get into even more trouble. The fact that Billy Ray followed this up by taking his dog for a walk rather than reporting for duty seems to suggest that he just wanted some final moments of peace before he went through the act of hanging himself. I've seen the photo of Billy Ray's suicide note during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and it's quite lengthy, but while it might seem unusual that he wrote this while he was outdoors during a window of only about 20 minutes, he may have been planning suicide for a while and had already pre-written the note and was carrying it around with him for when the moment finally arrived. That seems more believable to me than someone killing Billy Ray outside his residence during this 20-minute window while he was walking his dog and wasn't even supposed to be there to begin with. Well, it is odd that the Army even acknowledged that the suicide note may not have even been in Billy Ray's handwriting. It seems awfully risky for an outside party to kill Billy Ray and take the time to write a fake suicide note while his dog is there and his wife is still inside the house. Kim claimed that she went outside and found Billy Ray after she heard the dog barking, but if Billy Ray had been attacked by an outside party and the suicide was staged, wouldn't the dog have started barking much earlier? And while I'm not sure how accurate this detail is, the Unsolved Mysteries reenactment of the scene where Kim discovers Billy Ray's body depicts the dog as being tied up to the porch with his leash, and it seems far more believable that Billy Ray would do that before he hanged himself. Granted, I'm not sure if I have much of an explanation for the abrasions on Billy Ray's body, but the big issue is that I just don't see any motive for foul play here. While the families of Jeffrey Digman and Mike Carmichael believe that they had uncovered incriminating information which put their lives at risk, I see no indication of that in Billy Ray's case, and as controversial as the forged recommendation letter may have been, would it really compel someone to kill him several months after the fact? And this leads to the weird contradiction with Mike Carmichael's death, in that his so-called suicide does seem a lot more suspicious, yet I cannot think of a logical reason for someone to want to kill him either. The theory pushed forward is that Mike was performing this independent investigation into Billy Ray's death and may have uncovered evidence that his friend was murdered. Mike has supposedly assembled a collection of important private papers which he kept in a metal box that just happened to disappear after he died, but even though he mentioned it to several people, were there any eyewitnesses who actually saw this metal box? Even if his wife saw and he saw the box, was she privy to the contents of the papers it contained? One of the most confusing aspects of this story is that Mike allegedly collected a letter that Billy Ray had written to his father, Harvey Hargrove, shortly before he died, but the letter was never mailed out, and it was presumably put inside the metal box before it disappeared. During his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Harvey said that if he could find the letter, he believed it might explain everything, but if Mike had the letter in his possession for a while, did he not at least share its contents with Harvey at some point? Mike's family claimed that the metal box was lying on a desk in his barracks office when he was found dead, but then it mysteriously disappeared. However, they seem to be basing this on a sketch of the crime scene, which featured a rectangular object on a desk, and I'm not sure if there were any actual photographs of this box. The Army denied that this box existed, but it's possible that the situation is the same as with the missing safe and the diary pages in the Jeffrey Digman case. The Army may have simply held onto the box because the papers inside contained sensitive, confidential information which could not be turned over to civilians, but there was nothing in there to suggest a conspiracy involving the murder of two soldiers. According to his uncle Oscar, Mike told him there were at least three other soldiers besides Billy Ray who had been the victims of suspicious suicides while stationed in South Korea, but we have no further details about these other cases, and the claims do sound pretty exaggerated. All that being said, the thing that bothers me the most about this case are the events preceding Mike's death. As you recall, Mike was celebrating his 38th birthday at his residence with his wife and friends when he received an unexpected phone call ordering him back to the base. Unfortunately, we don't have any specific details about who made that call and what they might have said to Mike, and I wonder if Unsolved Mysteries or anyone else related to Mike were privy to that information. It sounds like Mike didn't give off any warning signs at the party that something was wrong, so if his death was a suicide, what compelled him to suddenly go through with it after he reported to the base and went inside his barracks office? At least with Digman and Hargrove's deaths, we can understand why they might have decided to kill themselves at that particular time, but with Carmichael, it's a lot more unclear. Of course, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you can assume that the phone call ordering Mike back to the base was an elaborate setup in order to murder him and stage his suicide. Mike had some welts and an unexplained gash on his forehead, and hanging himself from the door handle of a locker only a few inches off the ground is admittedly an unusual way to kill oneself. Yes, there are documented cases in which people have died by asphyxiation after hanging themselves from locations only a few inches or feet off the ground, such as the legendary Robin Williams, who hanged himself with a belt that was wedged between a closet door and the door frame. But I can see why it might appear as if Mike could have been killed in the barracks office and the responsible party was forced to improvise by staging a suicide in which he was hanged from a locker door handle. If foul play did take place, I can't rule out the possibility that it could have been some sort of heat-of-the-moment thing where Mike got into a confrontation with someone inside the office, which led to him being killed, but the whole thing was completely unrelated to Billy Ray's death and was not some sort of grand cover-up or conspiracy. If they had to do some quick improvising to stage Mike's death, this could account for the metal wire that Sun He said she noticed around Mike's neck, which seemed to go missing. But if this is what happened, no one has ever been pushed forward as a potential suspect. The army seemed to think that Mike was feeling suicidal over the recent loss of his best friend, as well as potential financial problems, such as the possibility of his ex-wife getting half of his retirement pay when he decided to retire later that year. But while Billy Ray's marriage was described as being tumultuous, everyone who knew Mike said that his marriage to Sun He was a very happy one. All that being said, I find it quite telling that unlike the rest of Mike's loved ones, Sun He actually accepted the suicide ruling. She was the one living with him every day while he was thousands of miles away from his own family, so I can't help but wonder if she observed something about Mike which made her believe that he may have been depressed, suicidal, or suffering from serious mental health issues. As unusual as it might be to hang oneself in this fashion, Sun He didn't seem to have any issues believing that Mike did this, and she even agreed to be interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, even though the segment was going to have a very pro-homicide slant. So what could Sun He have known about Mike that the rest of his family didn't? Perhaps if Billy Ray had not ended his own life, Mike never would have considered suicide, but witnessing his best friend do that gave him the final push he needed. For all we know, when Mike kept sharing these stories about how he was going to investigate Billy Ray's death, he may have been planting the seeds to make them believe he would get murdered too, so they wouldn't have to deal with the stigma of believing he died by suicide. Now, unlike many of these other suspicious suicide cases, the two victims' families managed to convince a sitting U.S. Representative, Jay Dickey, that there may have been foul play, but it ultimately led to a congressional hearing, in which it was concluded that the original suicide rulings were correct. In spite of this, the family still continued to believe that both men were murdered, and I have a feeling that nothing will ever change their minds. So overall, I still have some reservations about Carmichael's death, though I would generally lean towards suicide. I feel the same way about Digman's case, and I don't have any doubts at all that Hargrove took his own life. However, even if no homicides actually took place per se, I still think these suspicious suicide cases are worth exploring, if only to take a serious look at the issues of depression and mental health. A lot of these cases I explore took place decades ago, when there was more of a stigma surrounding suicide, so you can understand why the victim's loved ones would be in denial. And I'm sure the situation is even more complicated when the victim was in the military, where you're supposed to give off the impression that you're strong and may not be willing to openly acknowledge any internal struggles you might be experiencing. I'd like to think that attitudes about suicide and mental health have evolved since then, but we still have a long way to go, so if you are struggling with depression or have suicidal thoughts, please talk to someone or seek help. But if by chance you happen to have any information to suggest that the deaths of Jeffrey Dignan, Billy Ray Hargrove, and Mike Carmichael were actually homicides, please contact the appropriate authorities. And if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in Tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode, which is our podcast's second special edition of The Trail Revisited, and this time, I'm taking a fresh look at the infamous Circleville Letters case. I originally covered that story on the podcast 6 years ago, but I've since learned a ton of new information which has caused me to look at the case in a different light, so I decided to put together an entirely new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1989 disappearance of Patricia Meehan. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. Oh, and as an extra special bonus, I recorded an additional audio commentary this month over the recent Unsolved Mysteries Behind the Legacy documentary, and this one is available to all of our Patreon subscribers. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past few weeks, and they are Sundine R, Joe, Rebecca N, Rachel, Kate, Alyssa P, Anna T, and Julie E. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also excited to announce that The Trail Went Cold will be returning again to the True Crime Podcast Festival this year, which is being held at the Denver Marriott Westminster in Colorado from July the 12th to the 14th. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a discount code for 15% off, so please visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL for 15% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which has a lot of interesting discussions about today's featured cases. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.